Thomas, and I am the Senior Multifaith Educator at Global Spiritual Life at NYU, and this is Multifaithful, the podcast about religious diversity, multifaith dialogue, and effing the ineffable. In this week's podcast, I am joined by a friend and interfaith colleague, Grace Patterson, who most often does interfaith religious literacy workshops with me across NYU, and works for an amazing organization called World Faith, which you'll learn about very soon. We are going to discuss the role of interfaith in international community development and how things like climate change are connected to causes like preventing HIV. Thank you for listening to Multifaithful, and now to this week's conversation. I am joined today by a good friend and interfaith colleague, Grace Patterson, who's the director of Global Programs for an amazing organization called World Faith, which she's going to tell us more about. Thanks for being with us, Grace.
Thank you, Ryan.
And I'm joined once again by one of our favorite student guests, Hannah. You want to introduce yourself?
I'm Hannah. I am a master's student in the Institute of French Studies, and I work here at the office, and I'm happy to be here.
So, Grace, you and I became friends in college when we took John Sexton's Baseball is a Road to God.
That's right.
Now, it's not entirely clear to me that he convinced either of us that baseball is a road to God. I think you because you're a non-theist, and me because I find baseball boring. But besides that point, you have since taken on working for World Faith.
Yeah.
And organizing a lot of international interfaith service. So maybe you could start by just telling us, what does World Faith do generally? Because I know they're doing amazing things.
So thank you, Ariel. First of all, I'm really excited to be here and to be talking with you guys, even though I get to talk to you informally all the time.
All the time.
But it's a blessing to do it formally as well. So World Faith is a terrific organization. Yes, I am an NYU alum. I'm an alum of the Gallatin School of Individualized Study. So
I believe the official term is a Gallatina.
A Gallatina, that's correct. And Sexton's class was was a Gallatin class, and I'm pretty proud of my Gallatin alum status. My concentration there was religious diversity and governance, so right in line with the stuff that we're talking about. And it was a really phenomenal experience. I was also at NYU Abu Dhabi for a year. And while I was at Gallatin, I did an internship with this organization called World Faith because I was interested in interfaith development, and had a really tremendous experience. And when I graduated, the founder, Frank Frederick, said that they were hiring and sent me a job description, and the rest is history, as you might say. Frank is also an NYU alum. The organization actually got started as an NYU club.
Wow.
And one of our chapters is still an NYU club. So along with our continued relationship with the university, we're very much an NYU-grown organization in a lot of ways, which is pretty cool. The majority of our work happens overseas, though. Mm-hmm. We do have a chapter here, but most of it happens in Southeast Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. And ultimately, we're an interfaith organization. Our mission is to end religious violence. But as we understand it, religious violence doesn't just come from not being familiar with religious others. It also comes from underlying socioeconomic factors that lower the threshold for violence. So we mobilize religiously diverse teams of young people to tackle community development projects in their local community. And so interfaith is part of our DNA, and building relationships between folks of different religious traditions is definitely part of our DNA. But we're also tackling sort of another piece of the puzzle in looking at development projects.
Could you give us an example of like one project that's happening right now or has happened recently that can illustrate this well for people who maybe aren't as familiar with some of these areas?
I'm going to give you three. I can't do it in one,
We'll take three.
So we have three main programmatic areas because ultimately our chapters, we have 18 of them in 15 different countries. 13 different countries, 18 chapters, 13 countries. They have a lot of leeway about the work that they do. They have a lot of autonomy in terms of the work that they do, because ultimately the people that are best qualified to determine what a community needs are the folks that are in that community, right? So our chapter leaders get to decide what they work on, but it generally falls into one of three categories. Public health, that is HIV/AIDS awareness, so distributing condoms, running trainings for young people so that they know how HIV is transmitted and how to reduce their risk of contracting the disease. That includes climate change advocacy and awareness raising around the effects of climate change and strategies for mitigating those effects in the context of agriculture or any number of other things. So public health is one. Two is early childhood education, and that's exactly what it sounds like. We, for the most part, run schools. So in Malawi and in India and Delhi and in a couple of other places, Jos, Nigeria, we have schools. And they're either accredited by the government or they're unaccredited but work to sort of prepare students to matriculate into accredited programs. Across the board, our schools mean the difference between a kid eventually getting a degree and having a shot at employment, or a kid not getting a degree and, in the case of someone in Delhi, getting income from rag picking in the slum for their life, right? So we're breaking the cycle of poverty with education. And then the third and final sort of exemplary program falls under the bracket of women's empowerment. And there's a wide range of programming in that department, but in general, it's often livelihood skills education programs. So in some cases, that's tied to microfinance. So we train a cohort of women on, in the case of Abuja, Nigeria, we train them on tailoring skills, dressmaking and mending, and give them shared supplies and provide sort of like initial inputs that will allow them to start their own business and ultimately to be financially independent from anybody else. So that's women's empowerment. In some cases, it also means just basic literacy skills, right? Mm-hmm. Because ultimately, if you can't read, it's tough to access legal resources and governmental resources because you can't read paperwork or signage, right? Sometimes it also means like education around exactly what the laws are, right? Because you can't, in the case of, for example, Indonesia, there are protections in place, legal protections in place for women, but they're often not aware of them. And what good is a legal protection if
you don't know it exists?
Right, if you don't know it exists. So all of that is to say we do lots and lots of different things. I should say, too, that I don't know how much of this you want to use, but I think it's also important to note that they're all interconnected, right? Like often organizations will focus very specifically on one isolated problem. And that makes a lot of sense for a lot of reasons, right? You fully understand the scope of your mission. It's easier to determine what success looks like and to understand like exactly at what point you will have succeeded, right? Because you're focusing so small, which is totally valid. It makes a lot of sense and is helpful. But for us, for example, climate change, right? My colleague, chapter leader in Malawi, his name is Dominic, he does a lot of this training around the effects of climate change and mitigating the effects of climate change. And as he has explained it to me, it's not just about the environment and environmental impacts. It's also related to economic opportunity, because the alternating drought and flooding in Malawi erodes the traditional agricultural practices that many people use to survive. And when folks can't farm in the same way that they have for years, they're unemployed. And by the same token, so there's the connection to poverty, and by the same token, when folks are unemployed, who is more likely to find alternate employment? Men. Who is not? Women. And when women are unemployed and don't have alternate means of employment, often the only option is prostitution. Mm-hmm. And so then that raises their risk for contracting HIV/AIDS, mm-hmm. right? So like all of these things, poverty, mm-hmm. women's empowerment, public health, even early childhood education, right? It's all tied together and interconnected. Mm-hmm. And so our work allows and our model allows for a lot of diversity in terms of how we address those interconnected problems.
So what is it about coming at this from an interfaith lens that makes the work you guys do unique? Because, I mean, as you're speaking, it sounds to me like a lot of different initiatives that are going on through a lot of different nonprofits throughout the world, public health and women's empowerment, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
But what seems unique to me that I haven't heard as much about with other organizations is this approach through interfaith. So what does that do to help these causes that, you know, what is special about that approach?
Yeah, I mean, I would clarify to say that, like, I think that it's more accurate to say that development is our lens for interfaith than interfaith is our lens for development.
Yeah.
'Cause ultimately, it's important to us to be successful as a development organization, right? And to function on par with other development organizations in terms of the results that our programs bring. That said, we are definitely an interfaith organization, and we live that value through requiring that our chapter leadership, and in any case that it's possible, their beneficiaries, are religiously diverse. Mm. And I think that one of our central assertions is that peace building and international development are inextricably linked. Neither can succeed without the other, right? Development is not sustainable if it's happening in an environment where conflict disrupts systems, right? Violent conflict is fueled by folks being unemployed, by folks feeling like they have no agency in their country and their community, right? These two things go together and they feed each other in either a positive feedback loop or in a negative feedback loop. Mm-hmm. And so our work exists at that intersection, deliberately thinking about development as a peace-building strategy and peace-building as a development strategy.
And I know that you and I, Grace, have done a lot of interfaith or religious literacy trainings together, and I know you do them also outside of the context of NYU. So how has that skill been built through this work? Like, how have you come to doing these religious literacy or interfaith trainings? I know we all use kind of different words for similar things. Like, how did you get into that, and how do you go about doing that as part of the world faith ecosystem?
So, yeah, I think that you're right. We have a lot of names for the same mm-hmm. thing. And I've actually been thinking a lot about, like, what is interfaith, right? Is it a movement? Is it a field of study? What are the boundaries of it? Because there's a lot going on right now, mm-hmm. and it's having a kind of a renaissance. And it can move in any number of different directions.
Yeah.
So this is fascinating stuff. I'll say that, like, my central assumption is that if we are a movement, our goal as a movement, and lots of people would disagree with me, but our goal as an interfaith movement is to end religious violence, and religiously motivated violence,
mm-hmm.
right? Some people might say conflict,
right.
But I personally believe that we are never going to be without conflict as human beings. I'm concerned with that conflict not oppressing people violently, right? So to that end, there are a number of branches of the movement, right? There are folks who are concerned with specifically religious literacy mm-hmm. and education around interfaith engagement. Undeniably important. You need, like, a baseline understanding of different religious traditions in order to be respectful of people from different traditions. Having a baseline level of literacy reduces barriers to building relationships in an important way, right? If you can demonstrate a little bit of an effort not to offend and to be respectful, it goes a long way. So there are folks that are definitely concerned with that, both religious literacy in the sense of an understanding of the way that religion operates mm-hmm. in the world, and also intentionality around how we interact with one another in interreligious spaces or multi-faith spaces. So those are sort of mm-hmm. two interrelated pieces. There's the like domestic U.S. social justice-based folk who are, again, concerned with, you know, reducing the violence done mm-hmm. to others in part, if not in whole, in the name of religion or
right.
theology. There's us doing like our interfaith piece. And in some iteration, I've sort of had my fingers in all of that because I think I would say that we are a movement. And in any social movement, no one person can carry all mantles, right? Mm-hmm. Like there are some of us that have to be holding up different parts of this big tent in order to make it happen. So the World Faith work provides a really excellent frame of reference for talking about religious literacy and for a frame of reference for the personal experience that I share in those mm-hmm. trainings, because that's where my headspace is, that's where I come from. And by the same token, an understanding of a pedagogy around religious literacy is absolutely helpful in the World Faith work as a starting place for making sure that the folks that are involved in our programs have that baseline, right? Mm-hmm. And that is so important. So they definitely inform each other. And I think, again, I see all of these pieces
yeah.
of movement as being interrelated.
Mm-hmm.
So in this line of work, what keeps you going? What keeps you motivated? Because I know, at least for me, coming into the world of social justice, even I'm really young, I'm just still getting into it, but sometimes it's feels like there's just this mountain, and it's like, how can we ever actually
yeah.
start? I mean, you may feel like you're changing things, but it also feels like there's so many other things that are going wrong. So,
yeah.
and maybe that's not how you feel, but nonetheless, what keeps you going when that feeling does come?
No, I think you're not alone. I think what you're describing resonates with me and would resonate with a lot of people. You know, there are a bunch of answers, right? Self-care is one of them,
mm-hmm.
and work-life balance. It can be really easy for folks in this world to work all the time and in a never-ending way. And I think part of that is that there will always be so much to do and to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of that is about a sense that somebody else doesn't have the option to not.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a sense of responsibility to be hyper-dedicated. But I know for myself that if I was in that mode, if I was working those 100-hour weeks,
mm-hmm.
80-hour weeks, I'd burn out in about 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I am invested in being able to do this work for the long haul.
Mm-hmm.
And so finding work-life balance is an act of sustainability, right?
Mm-hmm.
How finding sustainability. And the other piece too is, you know, I hear you say that it's hard to feel like you're doing good, but there is way more good to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the moments when I feel least like that are when I'm in conversation with other people who are doing other pieces of this work.
Mm-hmm.
One, because we have shared experience, right? And sort of like it's always good to hear somebody else articulate your anxieties and your frustrations,
mm-hmm.
right? To hear them come out of somebody else's mouth so that you know you're not crazy. But also
that's been the purpose of this entire podcast. Just to have other people say things like that. So like, oh, I'm not crazy.
Right, exactly,
yeah,
exactly. I'm not a lunatic. So that's definitely part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But another part of it too is that like continuing to remind myself that I can't do it all.
Mm-hmm.
I'm only one human being. And being in community with others who are doing this work is such a relief. Because it's like, oh, that person is doing, that needs to happen,
mm-hmm.
and I can't carry that piece. But she's doing it,
mm-hmm.
and she's awesome,
mm-hmm.
and she's the one that should be doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And how can I support her as a human being or in her professional life, right?
Mm-hmm.
So being in community with other people who are doing this work, even if it's just to laugh at ourselves. And the pitfalls of what we're doing is really important. Keeping going.
So I'm curious. I want to switch tracks for a second because I know one of the, when you do a lot of trainings with someone, you also get a sense of like what they're really good at.
Sure.
And so I've actually then, besides our trainings, I've brought you in working with groups of students to work on the particular skill of being able to tell your own story and personal narrative as a way of communicating a value to someone else.
Yeah.
And it's almost like a, using your narrative as a sermon in some ways. And I know that you're particularly good at that. and I'm curious why, in especially in interfaith setting, like why is that a skill that you think is good for people to develop or to think about? Because it's frankly one that I'm not good at. I really struggle to tell like my own life trajectory about like why I care about multi-faith. I'm not sure I can draw that straight line, but you actually can. You do it, you do it really effectively. And so I'm curious, like why is that helpful? What does that do for people?
I think that we make the mistake a lot when we're trying to compel people or to convince people of like pulling out statistics as an arsenal to say like, if I line up enough facts, then this person will believe me. And the fact of the matter is that's just not true. It might be true in an academic paper when there's time for reflection and for reviewing research, etc. But it's just not true in interpersonal conversations. Try it. Experiment, right?
I'm pretty sure this, right before this podcast, the Senate voted 50-49 that global warming is not caused by human beings.
Yeah.
So
wow.
If you needed any more proof that facts don't convince, there you go.
Yeah, well, I mean,
also, apparently that World Faith doesn't have to continue doing work on climate change.
The Senate solved it.
Apparently the Senate solved the issue today, so
yeah,
we're all in good shape.
Well, I think that's a great example of scientific knowledge not trickling down to the thought, right, of the academy is that we will be these bastions of knowledge production and we will produce all of this knowledge and it will exist and once it exists, then everyone will understand it and act accordingly. And that's just not borne out in the way that people operate. And
hearing you say that, it almost strikes me as absurd.
It is absurd, because ultimately, one, the academy doesn't prioritize disseminating that information in a way that's accessible, right? Often, like, you literally need to be at an institution in order to have a subscription to JSTOR to read the article in the first place.
Yes.
Right? It's not only is it inaccessible in all of the, like, justice-y ways that we think about, right? Of, like, you have to have the money to be at an institution.
Right.
In many cases, you have to be a white male in order to get ahead at an institution, right? But also, very literally, you need a password in order to access that paper, right? So the academy is often not very good at like taking this produced knowledge and translating it into a way that other people can hear. But I would suggest do this experiment, right? Like you are passionate, let's say you're passionate about climate change, right? Do a thing where you're attempting to convey to others why you're passionate about climate change, right? And in a very calm way, lay out 3 or 4 facts, right? And watch their eyes glaze over. And then attempt to tell them a story about somebody who is experiencing homelessness, right? Connected to the, how many million refugees are there right now from Syria? Let's call it 5 million. Let's say that there are currently 5 million people displaced by the crisis in Syria, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the next 50 years, potentially 145 million people will be displaced by rising sea levels. 145 million people. We don't know what to do with 5 million people displaced, right? When I heard that stat it was a forum for faith-based leadership around climate change at the White House. State Department put it together. That was the first stat I had heard all day that connected what was happening to actual lives, right?
Mm-hmm.
To the human face of all of this sort of like nebulous, abstract stuff that we're talking about when we're talking about climate change. So, and I woke up, right? Mm-hmm. And I was listening all of a sudden. He had me, because he was very clearly saying, this is a huge problem because related to our current life, right? How many folks are currently displaced and the entire world doesn't know what to do. And the difference between 5 million and 145 million. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, I was terrified, right? Because I viscerally understood what that meant, right? He wasn't just giving me a statistic, because I'm not saying that statistics are not important and that the production of knowledge is not important. I'm saying that it has to be connected to human stories in order to be meaningful for other people. And so telling your own story is the easiest story to tell.
Right.
It's the hardest in some ways. But once you practice it, right? Once you, like, get your head around it, your story is the easiest to tell. And it's also going to be the most compelling to talk from your personal experience to somebody about... And don't tell them, like, why you believe that climate change is a big issue. Tell them why you initially believed it.
Mm.
Tell them what made your mind up. Tell them about your particular transformative experience. I'll be honest, I did not particularly care about climate change until about less than a year ago. And what happened was that two converging things happened. The first was
this
that
is great. I was going to ask you what's your best interfaith story here. This will do. This is good.
Okay, good. So yeah, so I didn't care about climate change until about a year ago, when two things were happening. The first was that I was having conversations with Dominic, my colleague in Malawi, about putting together a climate change program in his community, and I was wrestling with how it fit into our mission, and started to think about all of this interconnectedness that we already talked about, the fact that climate change creates poverty because of the eroding of the soil as a result of alternating drought and flooding, right? Poverty creates even more of a gap between opportunity for men and opportunity for women.
Mm.
When women are deprived of opportunity for employment, often they resort to prostitution, right? Which raises their risk for HIV/AIDS. I had that moment of understanding how it was all connected. And I also went to church. I'm a Unitarian Universalist.
Mm-hmm.
And at church, the pastor was talking about climate change, and I started to tune out, and she said, look, I get that you're more concerned about racial justice. She was saying this to the congregation, but all of a sudden I felt like she was talking to me. She was like, I get that you're more concerned about racial justice. I get that you're more concerned about income inequality. I get that you have what feel like more pressing concerns. But if we don't also address climate change, all of your work to make those injustices right, to heal those injustices, is rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic.
Ooh. Whoa.
Right?
Oh my gosh.
And I went, oh crap. You're absolutely right.
Wow.
What does it matter if we spend the next 50 years making sure that nobody has to live on the street? If in 50 years... 145 million people are displaced by rising sea levels, and all of the progress that we've made is for naught, right? It's a band-aid on the hole in the Hoover Dam. So, but again, all of the decades of facts about climate change and the photos of polar bears or the video of polar bears with sad music behind them didn't do it for me, right? What did it for me is understanding the interconnectedness and somebody telling me a really good story about it, right?
Well, not to get too meta, but that was a really good story about telling a good story.
It was.
That was very, very well done.
You gotta practice what you preach, right?
I know, seriously.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining us. This was a lot of fun.
Okay,
hopefully
thank
we'll have you.
You
back again soon.
Thank you for joining us at another episode of Multifaithful, and especially like to thank our guest and my friend Grace Patterson for doing all those faith zone sessions with me throughout the year, and for joining us on the podcast, and for just always being around the office and making the office a lot of fun. Also, thank you to Hannah for joining us once again and being a brilliant and amazing student interviewer. Thank you to Liz Spatos. His music is originally from The Of Many Film, and to Brian Young for editing and producing the podcast in absentia. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please be in touch at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Please rate and review us on iTunes, and we look forward to having you back in another episode.